Thank you, Ellie. And thank you, Ellie and Ethel, for sponsoring this new initiative. It's an exciting thought to have diverse voices and something to look forward to in the next few years. I want to explain the background noise. We hired an audience to cheer indiscriminately for literature. They are what we call naive readers. So they don't always cheer at the right moment. My class will know about that. We've been talking about the difference between naive readers and sophisticated readers. So it takes the pressure off of all of you. It didn't occur to me that you are our longest serving veteran.
I'm trying, honey. I'm here.
The cheers erupt. And as we said a couple times so far, Emily Mitchell is the newest member of the creative writing faculty here at West Virginia, and we feel very fortunate to have her. My sense is also talking to students that they feel that good fortune too, that Emily has very quickly established herself as a writer who is brilliantly able to translate the particularities and eccentricities of craft into a language that makes writing accessible and available. And that's not easy. But I imagine that she makes a book that way. Much as in reading her remarkable first novel, The Last Summer of the World, which was published by Norton in 2007 and released in paperback last year, that it's easy to be swept away by her fluent marriage of history and imagination, and by prose that is both imagistically precise and musically acute. It's the sort of book that is so instantly absorbing, it's easy, that word again, to believe that the writing came effortlessly. And as we all know, that's almost never the case. As reviewers have noted, this novel is dazzling, and its writer is the real thing. In addition to receiving mountains of critical acclaim, The Last Summer of the World was a finalist for the New York Public Library's prestigious Young Lions Award. And in light of the attention it and she have received, Emily was named a fellow at the Breadloaf Writers Conference. She's published short fiction and essays in many magazines and journals, including Agni, Raritan, the Indiana Review, the New England Review, the New York Times Book Review, and others. And when she's not in the creative writing workshop, she's hard at work on a new novel, while also writing short stories, one of which she'll be reading here tonight. As I said, we're very lucky to have her here at WVU, so please welcome the real thing, Emily Mitchell.
Thank you, Jim, for that lovely introduction. I can't lean on this too much. And thank you guys all for coming out this evening. I am, as Jim said, going to read... I'm going to read one and a half short stories this evening. It's so nice to get to share a podium in an evening with Alessa High. What a wonderful reading that was. I realized as I was listening that we have a concern in common, and it's a concern with place in our work. Alessa is a person who has very deep roots in this place and in this community. And I'm a very new arrival, and I'm also a person where I'm not even sure where I'm from anymore. When people ask, that kind of a life can have the effect of making you very interested in place and the way that a particular geography shapes human experience. So the two stories that I'm going to read today, both share that concern. The first story is appeared in the magazine Raritan this fall, and it's called Vanishing Bicycle. And just to give you a little bit of background, I was working for a magazine that looked at free expression issues, and we were reviewing a book called The Commissar Vanishes, which is a collection of photographs from the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc from the period before the fall of communism. And the book showed pictures of mostly public figures where they had been doctored, sometimes immediately, sometimes gradually. So there would be like a picture of Lenin and Trotsky and like 25 people standing on the steps of the Kremlin. And then there would be a picture of Lenin and Trotsky and strangely nobody else on the steps of the Kremlin. And then finally there'd be a very large, slightly grainy picture of Lenin. I was hoping they would cheer. standing just, you know, by himself on the steps of the Kremlin. And one of the things that the writer, the editor of this book said is that in some cases in Eastern Bloc countries under communism, people even doctored their own personal photographs. So I got to thinking about you know, what that would mean. And this story came up with that. Vanishing Bicycle, 1989. 25 years pass, and then one day he comes to the door unannounced. She is in the back room of the apartment, watering her begonias when he arrives, an ordinary task for an ordinary morning. He's breathing hard from climbing the four flights of winding wooden stairs, and he can see his own breath swirling out in ice-colored gusts as he waits in the hallway. It is so cold in November. He rubs his hands together. The light is bright but colorless, mediated by a layer of pale cloud which seals the city in like a lid. What astonishes him most is how little has changed. In the West, the city would be unrecognizable to someone absent for so long. These streets, he knew them so well as a child, as a young man, he barely noticed their appearance. Now, memories rise with each corner he turns, sharp, vivid, without regard for whether he is ready to receive them. This block of apartments, this row of shops, that park, he played football there. People stare at him. His good clothes give him away. He could have driven here and been insulated from all this. He thinks he must have chosen to walk precisely so that he might receive these wounds. He does not know what he is going to find. He doesn't know if she is still living where she was. He doesn't know what she has been told, whether any of his letters reached her or if they were confiscated. He gave up trying to telephone years ago. So, standing on the threshold, which is familiar to him as his own face, though he recalls it being bigger, less shabby, he hesitates. He does not ring the bell for a moment or two. Instead, he contemplates going back through the cold streets, back the way he came and trying to call, or making inquiries through the proper government channels, or hiring a private investigator, like an American would. But it is cold, and he has walked all this way, and he cannot have come here only to go away with nothing, the same nothing that he came with. He raises his hand and rings the bell. She hears the doorbell and looks worriedly around the apartment to see if there is anything lying around she shouldn't have. Who would be calling in the middle of the day like this? In recent years, the police have not been bothering her as much as they used to. They have other things to keep them busy these days, with all the unrest and the students marching and who knows what going on out there. She is grateful for the peace and quiet, but knows that it is temporary and they will come eventually. Always it is temporary and things must be blemishless and blameless when they do arrive. There are always others, good citizens, good patriots, in need of a lovely spacious apartment like this, Frau Liebling, she remembers the inspector saying once. So she tries to answer their questions as best she can, even if she doesn't understand all the things they are asking her, or know any of the people they want information about. Just coming, she shouts towards the closed door. She puts the watering can in the sink and takes off the apron she has put on over her house dress. She smooths the front of her clothing and snatches a glimpse in the mirror to make sure that she is presentable. A small, lined face with tidy hair pulled away from her forehead into a gray bun at the back, and a delicate, bow-shaped mouth. She winces. She is tired to death of that face. On the table behind her is a silver photograph frame that she had not noticed when she first looked to make sure her room was correct. She sees it now reflected in the mirror. How stupid, she thinks. What am I going to do with that? Where am I going to hide him? She spins around, rushes to it, and scoops it up in her hands. She is momentarily at a loss for what to do. A young man, about 20 years old, stares out of the frame between her fingers. It is a bright day, and he is standing under the boughs of a linden tree, holding the handlebars of what looks like a bicycle. It is difficult to tell now what might have been there, because the bottom half of the picture is cut away, following an irregular curved line. In its place, the cardboard backing of the picture frame shows through, grayish brown. The handlebars and part of the basket, all that is left visible, look old, used, a little rust climbing up around the neck. The boy in the picture is looking straight at the camera and smiling. But on closer inspection, it becomes apparent that the smile is a forgery. He wants to make the photographer believe he is happy. He wants to please the photographer, but he is not happy himself. It's his eyes that steal out and betray him, dark and luminous like a wild animal's caught in headlamps. Even in the picture, you can see their depth, see them tremble as if they are on the brink of tears. He is melancholy, but more than that, he is afraid. He has reason to be so. And to try to hide the fear, to bury it beneath the assumed warmth of that smile. The previous week, two of his friends were shot trying to cross the border to the other side of the city. Gustav and Clara, who were also students at the university, who are now no longer spoken of by anyone, either in public or in private. No one had known they were going to go. They had planned in complete secrecy, confiding only in each other, though everyone knew that Clara's mother was on the other side. It had always gaped at the edge of conversations, a possibility. The only thing that had given him any hint of their plans was something Gustav had said about a week before he disappeared for the last time. They had been sitting outside after lectures, and Gustav had seemed distracted. He had been kicking a piece of broken glass with the toe of his shoe. Suddenly he turned and said, "You know, some people do make it across. Most don't." Gustav said, "Yes, that's right, most don't. But would they tell us about the ones who did? They would only tell us about the ones who were killed. Gus, have you seen the soldiers? Anyway, what are you talking about this for?" "Nothing, nothing, no reason." And that was the last mention of the crossing Gustav ever made to his friend, who 3 weeks later is posed for this photograph, which his mother has demanded he stand still for. "Smile, Kurgan," she says, "you must smile. This is a happy occasion." She is proud of having managed to procure the bicycle for him. They are still not so easy to get, and she has pulled some strings to find him this thing he has been wanting for some time. To mark the event, she has dragged Uncle Max's old box camera out so she can have a picture to remember it by. She is hurt that he seems distracted, that he receives this gift with something close to indifference. So to make his mother happy, he smiles. He does not tell her that the police have roused him from sleep each night since his friends were killed. He does not tell her that when they take him to the station for questions, they threaten to harm her as well, or that they keep him awake for hours, or they ask him again and again questions that mean nothing to him. They ask him about the network of counter-revolutionary infiltrators and American operatives to which they know he belongs, until in the end the words shatter into noises without meaning, such as animals and machines make. The syllables, just blunt bits of sound that they strike him with over and over. He is so exhausted that his vision has become grainy as a cinema newsreel. Events and people flicker past him, insubstantial as ghosts. They always come at night after he is asleep. He tried to stay awake to be ready for them, so each night they arrive a little later. Now he wakes in the night at the slightest disturbance. Footsteps on the pavement outside his window jolt him into consciousness. Even sometimes the heat creaking through the pipes is enough. The bicycle his mother produces as a surprise, as a victory over the entropy that is breaking apart things around them. If one can acquire a bicycle today, there might be no end to what one will do next week, next month, next year. To Kurgan, it looks just like what it is, an old bike which will be fit for nothing but scrap soon, usable for another 6 months, maybe a year if he's lucky. It is not really a match for the darkness into which he has been thrown without warning. His illusion that things are getting better has drowned. When the war stopped and reconstruction began, the thought took root that the world would improve bit by bit, partly because they couldn't imagine it could get any worse. Somehow people thought that at last there would be some kind of peace. Kurgan has lived with that vision all his life. Now he realizes how much worse things can become. Looking at the photograph years later, Kurgan's mother remembers his vague unease that day, and in retrospect knows, of course, it must have been something to do with his subsequent disappearance. 3 weeks later and he is gone, taking almost nothing with him. The police bring his belongings for her to identify. Some clothes, a photograph of his parents together before the war, a watch that had belonged to his grandfather. They tell her that he was killed trying to cross to the west. He had ridden the bicycle out of the city and tried to cross on open ground. They say he was shot and killed by one of the sentries. She asks if she could bring his body home. They do not give her a reply. The inspector merely says, "I shouldn't think it would be advisable for you to have anything more to do with a traitor such as your son." When they leave, she does not pause for a minute. She has herself and the rest of her family to think of now. She goes to his room and clears it out and feeds the contents piece by piece to the fire. The orange bear, the blue turtle crackle and smolder as their skins shrivel in the flames and the stuffing goes up in small explosions. The snakes and ladders set, the school books, the diploma from the gymnasium. His clothes she throws away. They will be taken out to the municipal dump and vanished among the rubbish of other people's lives. Then she takes down the photograph album from the top of her wardrobe. With a small pair of nail scissors, she carefully excises him from all the pictures. This leaves jagged and oddly shaped absences where he had stood with his arms around her or grinning among the other boys and girls. Her hands shake as she clambers up through the years of his life towards the present moment, but she is intent on her task. So intent, in fact, that she doesn't notice she is crying until she glances down at the soft fabric dividing the pages of photographs and sees the uneven circular marks of falling water. She is confused at first, not knowing where they come from. It is just the last photograph she has of him that she cannot bear to destroy. It is not yet developed when he goes, and she is caught unawares by it several months later when Max tells her that he has it. He did not want to bring it up earlier, he says. She understands why, of course, but the photo in its current incarnation still presents its own dilemma. She thinks, "I will just get rid of it like the rest. I have to be practical. I have to think of the ones who are left." But when she sees it, she loses her nerve. It is the last thing she has, and she can't bear the idea of parting with that day under the linden trees, the bicycle, the sunlight, all of it. She says to Max, "I wish you had thrown it away and never told me about it." In the end, she compromises. She gets out her scissors and cuts away not the boy, but the bicycle in the foreground. It would be better for them not to know it was a gift, something she had arranged for him to have. She must take his legs off to get rid of it, but she decides that the top half of her son is better than nothing. She wonders momentarily why they hadn't brought her the frame of the bicycle, along with the watch, the photograph, the other things. Surely a man who was shot would fall off sideways, would skid into a ditch, would crash into a tree at the roadside. They brought back his other personal affects. Why not the bike? Why not? In the space where there is no bicycle, a little seed takes root. She pushes it away at first, but it remains. Perhaps there is no bent frame and mangled tires because he was not shot. Perhaps he made it across after all. She pushes the thought away. She has seen the guards along the border. She isn't so sentimental yet that she will fool herself this way. She puts the misshapen remains of the photograph on a piece of cardboard backing. She keeps it under a pile of old clothes at the back of her wardrobe, and later, when things ease a bit and the police begin to leave the family alone, she puts it in a frame and keeps it on the windowsill in her small apartment. She polishes the metal frame often. some especially grey and dismal days, it is the brightest thing in the whole room. And when it is cold, too, she thinks that it is also a little warmer than the surrounding air. Maybe. It is as though, through the years, the room with its dusty bookshelves and sagging furniture and fraying rugs were fading, growing grainy, blurred at the edges and out of focus. The doorbell rings again. She runs to the bedroom and flings the frame into her laundry basket. It falls softly among the socks and undergarments. She covers it over and replaces the lid. The ringing has turned to knocking. Frau Liebling, it is a man's voice, deep but strained and tired. Yes, just a moment. She checks herself in the mirror again to make sure she doesn't look flustered. And then she opens the door. I'm going to read just a couple of sections of another short story that is more recent than that. And I was thinking very recently, and I think periodically, about the ways in which it's possible to organize fiction. And I was thinking about lists and listing and the enthusiasm that we have in our culture for making lists of stuff. And I was also thinking about travel guides. And the way in which, because we're, we move so much, we're so mobile, we very often need guidebooks to places. And I thought about a guidebook to places that, that we might, in fact, have been to, or we might not have been to. So this is a story called States, and I'm just going to read a couple of the entries. States. Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is the softest state in the Union. Early in its history, when it was still a colony, Pennsylvania passed an ordinance outlawing sharp corners for the good of the citizenry. As a result, the craftsmen of Pennsylvania pioneered a style of furniture making that came to be known as rustic curvature for its solid forms and smooth undulating lines. In recent years, reproductions of these designs have been enjoying a renewed popularity. The no-corner rule meant that Pennsylvania never became a center of industry like many of its neighbors, but has remained indebted to agriculture for much of its economic base. The statute has never been removed from the books, though today it is rarely enforced. In Pennsylvania, the mountains are shaped like breasts. That is not discussed by most people and not taught in the public schools. The culture of the rural western half of the state tends to be both conservative and to also exhibit a great love of birds, fried foods, and small boxes. Pennsylvania is an old state and therefore a sad one. More than 200 years ago, it was vivisected so it could be made into farms. The houses peel paint, and the little towns knotted around crossroads seem often to have forgotten what they wanted to say next. The official motto of the state is, when in doubt, breathe, but not through your mouth. New York. Brashness is well known to characterize New Yorkers in their public life, but they are all absolute kittens in private. The homes of New York are often decorated with mirrors in unlikely places. Some people attribute this to unusually high local levels of vanity, but really it is just because mirrors are very inexpensive in this region. Also, people in New York tend to live in small houses and apartments, and mirrors make their rooms look bigger. Recently, there have been numerous cases of haunted mirrors, and this has caused problems for the police as well as homeowners. A typical haunted mirror appears normal until it is hung on a wall, and then the surface shifts, warps, and becomes a reflection not of the room or person physically opposite to it, but of the place the viewer really wishes to be. This can be a disturbing thing to learn about yourself or about your spouse, and a number of apparently happy marriages have been damaged or destroyed by haunted mirrors. The attorney who led the class action suit against the manufacturers said in her briefing to the press, "You think your husband is content at home and you discover he'd rather be trapped in a sock factory with his third grade teacher, Mrs. Swenson. We consider that this forced disclosure of subconscious desires causes undue pain and suffering to the victims, and in many cases, significant loss of income. The police have been instrumental in disturbing the chain of supply for the haunted bearers, though some residents feel they could be doing more. New York City is not the capital of New York, although it is the state's tallest city. There is some dispute about whether it is largest in terms of population, since many of its denizens have been shown conclusively to be constructed of glue, paper, and one other top secret ingredient. Regardless, New York City is truly a world city replete with grand avenues, skyscrapers, beautifully maintained city parks. There are a multitude of artistic and cultural establishments and tourist destinations. These include the famous statue, which stands guard over the harbor, raising her reading glasses in her left hand to peruse the great book clasped in her right. What is written in the stone pages has only been read by a handful of workers and restorers, as it is impossible to see from either below or from the platform in the brim of the statue's bowler hat, to which visitors can ascend by means of an interior staircase. These workers say that the pages of the book contain a list of slurs aimed at every race and ethnicity that has ever come to this most polyglot of cities, ranging through the most archaic to the most contemporary. The city fathers were not aware of this when the statue was put up. It was a gift from abroad, and by then it was too late. Periodically, a citizens group will organize to protest publicly that the book's contents go against the spirit of the city and should be erased, but someone else always counters that it would be wrong to destroy a famous work of art by altering it so drastically. The argument goes on until everyone gets tired and distracted by something more pressing. Because all groups are insulted with equal virulence in the pages of the book, no particular faction has been motivated to mount a sustained campaign to have the offending matter removed. The official state vermin of New York rotates biannually between the greater glowering cockroach and the egg rat, which can be distinguished by its blue webbed feet. Louisiana. There is no state of Louisiana. The fact that the myth of its existence persists so powerfully to this day can be attributed to the deep-seated desire that we all have for some place between the water and the land which is simultaneously both and neither. In this place, we are free to drift over a surface still and dark like glass, which parts before the painted prow of our small wooden boat. It is important that the boat be wooden so we can hear the creaking sound it makes as it eases through channels the color of licorice and among tangled vines trailing luminous moss. Our destination is a small, lonely building, a house or sometimes a general store or even a cantina hoisted above the water, broad stilts beneath each corner. What we find there differs from person to person. Sometimes the house is empty. Sometimes it is filled with people having a party and dancing. Sometimes it is only a single person waiting on the dock that extends out in front of the building, sitting there as though they would have remained in exactly that spot for however long it took us to find them. The other reason that the state of Louisiana continues to loom so large in our collective imagination is the great hoax of 1782. The hoax was orchestrated by a group of planters from the French West Indies who intended to entice capital investment to their enterprises from bankers in Paris and other European cities. They began to spread information about great and growing port cities along the southern coast of the North American mainland, which, they claimed, would soon precipitously increase trade between the United States, then a recently formed nation, and the islands of the Caribbean. They named these cities after cities in France and even went so far as to have woodcuts and etchings made illustrating various street scenes and public works then supposedly taking place in them. The artists they hired were talented and evoked with nothing but their imagination bustling and vibrant towns inhabited by peoples of all nations of the world living together, a spectacle which at that time had never been witnessed before. Soon it became au courant in the French capital to pepper one's speech with slang purported to originate in the Gulf cities. Where this slang truly came from, no one knows, though it shows similarities to the Basque language and also to Welsh. The campaign was a success. The investors of Europe were moved to open their purses, and money flowed to the French island colonies. But another unforeseen effect also resulted from the machinations of the conspirators, which was the increased interest in the part of the United States in acquiring the rich territory adjacent to its own. As we all know, the Louisiana Purchase of 1803 took place a mere 20 years after the planters first gathered over port and cigars to devise their plan. Once this purchase was made, of course, the Americans soon discovered their error. There were no Gulf cities. Louisiana was pure fabrication. But so many among the new revolutionary elite had staked their reputations on the purchase of this territory, including, of course, Thomas Jefferson himself, that they could hardly admit this publicly. So to protect the president's dignity, the fiction was maintained, as it is to this very day. California. The beauty of California is famous throughout the world. What is less known is that deep insecurities attend this innate loveliness, which are often overlooked by those who are jealous and therefore inclined to be unsympathetic. This terrible pervasive self-doubt manifests itself in numerous ways. The tendency towards rioting in the cities, for example, is one symptom. A high proportion of the population who believe the state of Louisiana is nothing more than a hoax perpetrated by the government is another. The earthquakes to which the coastal regions are prone are not due to self-image problems. They are just the result of a high level of plate tectonic activity in the region. The beaches of California bake to a lovely braised brown, but smell like big, ugly birds. The mountains, on the other hand, smell delightful. Because the state of California is so vast and because it contains such a diversity of places and people, it is impossible truly to do justice to it in the short space this present exposition allows. I would exhort the reader to stir herself, to shake off the lethargy that has settled onto her body like a fog, and go out and find the truth for herself. Take as little as possible with you, a sturdy pack, a notebook, a pencil, some candles, a picture of your most cherished window or door, a memento of the time in your life when you were most ashamed. You will bury this along the way. A warm hat. That should be sufficient. Thank you.